This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Members of Iraq's warring factions, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, met last month to talk about prospects for peace. But they didn't meet in Iraq. They went to Helsinki for a weekend of closed-door negotiations. The meeting was organized by my guest, Porig O'Malley. It was the second meeting of Iraqis O'Malley held in Helsinki. The participants agreed on a framework for negotiations. The next round of talks are planned for Baghdad. O'Malley is a distinguished professor of peace and reconciliation at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He grew up in Dublin and lived there during the Troubles. He worked on peace negotiations in Northern Ireland and South Africa. To demonstrate to the Iraqis that reconciliation is possible, O'Malley brought to the Helsinki meeting former enemies from Northern Ireland and former enemies from South Africa who had learned to work together in new governments. One of the South Africans who attended the Helsinki meeting is also my guest, Mac Maharaj. He was a leader of the African National Congress Underground and got to know Nelson Mandela when they were both prisoners on Robben Island. Maharaj was the first minister of transport in the post-apartheid government. O'Malley has written a book about Maharaj called Shades of Difference. Porig O'Malley, Mac Maharaj, welcome to Fresh Air. Mac Maharaj, you spent a long time as the leader of the African National Congress's underground. How much awareness do you think the people who were at this meeting of Iraqis, how much did they know about the history of the South African struggle?
I think all of them have taken interest in South Africa and Northern Ireland to one extent or another, some more deeply than the others. But when we go there and participate in their meetings as facilitators, what I saw them reacting to was that at one occasion, as Cyril Ramaphosa was chairing in his capacity as facilitator, and they had all spoken from the Iraqi side, he then came into the discussion and said, I have made the following notes of each of your concerns. And he listed them all. And he said, we will now try to address and enable you to talk around each of those issues. That inclusivity lit their eyes because he was not trying to say one group's views will prevail over another. He was saying each of these points that you have raised merit attention. And once he did that, he was articulating a principle that we had learned through our own experience.
You know, Porig O'Malley is the author of a book about you and your role in the struggle in South Africa. You were in prison for 12 years, and in the introduction to this book, which is written by Nelson Mandela, Mandela describes you as being legendary in South Africa for several things, including your ability to withstand unimaginable torture. Was it difficult for you to see the representatives of the government that was authorizing your torture? Was it possible early on in your attempts to participate in reconciliation to see them as anything but evil?
It wasn't that difficult a problem to be able to talk to the enemy who had been my torturers. And it wasn't difficult because while under torture in 1964, I learned to make a distinction in the case of a particularly brutal torturer. I learned to respect him for the way in which he conducted his torture. He was trying to understand me and trying to be one step ahead of my thinking. And I realized then, you may hate your enemy, but do not be trapped by that hatred, because then you are in danger of underestimating their capacity. You need to respect their technical skills while you hate and totally disagree with their philosophy, their political outlook, and their political program.
What was the most difficult aspect for you of working with the people who had been your enemy in a power-sharing government? And what was the most difficult thing about that that you wanted to communicate to the Iraqis?
The most difficult one was to get within the power-sharing arrangement an agreement on reconciliation and reconstruction that addressed the inequalities and the inheritance of that oppressive system of apartheid. Because there was a tendency for the white minority in South Africa and the party that represented them to merely say, forget the past, let's reconcile and shake hands and move forward without appreciating how much injury we had done to each other. So when the Iraqis listen to that experience, they begin to say, yes, we have deep wounds amongst ourselves as Iraqis, but we need to be able to deal with our differences within a political framework and a set of principles which do not require us to resort to violence and war with each other.
Porug O'Malley, did you ask the Bush administration for its blessing on this peace initiative that you've launched?
No. We never consulted anybody, but we allowed them through intermediaries to know what we were doing.
Terry, there are many initiatives going on around Iraq. This initiative in which we are involved is an independent and separate one, and its focus is merely to get the Iraqis together to put their own vision, which includes living amongst themselves with their differences but without resorting to violence. That way, they have a common national vision in which they can interact with the rest of the world, knowing what their national interests require. All other initiatives have the tendency to wrap in both external interests and the interests of Iraqis into one process. And I believe that what we are trying to do would be of interest to all external parties because it provides them with a basis to understand what Iraqis want for themselves.
So, Porug O'Malley, part of your job was organizing the conference, choosing the people from Iraq who would participate, convincing them to come. So you went to Iraq, and I understand you had like $40,000 in your pocket for travel money so that you could buy the airline tickets for the people who are going to be participating in the conference. I guess my first question is, it seems like it would be mighty unsafe to be in Iraq, which is already unsafe, and have $40,000 in your pocket.
Iraq is a cash economy. It's not a credit card economy. So if you have to purchase something, you have to purchase it with cash. But for the last year, that is since last June, I have spent 2 weeks of every month in Iraq, except for October, putting these conferences together and going to them to invite them to something is far more, it is different, Terry. They will say to me repeatedly, we've been invited to many conferences, but nobody has come here and actually asked us. We might get an email, we might get a telephone call, or we might get it through an agency, but you people are the first who have come to ask us. That establishes bonds between us.
Porug O'Malley, since you've been spending 2 weeks out of nearly every month for the past year in Iraq trying to organize the conflict resolution meeting, the conflict has become more personal for you because your life has been endangered by it. Through living in Iraq, did you find it difficult to not start taking sides?
Well, I lived in Northern Ireland and I'm Irish and learned not to take sides. So it is a lot easier not to take sides in Iraq. Every side in Iraq has grievances, and conflict is about dealing with people's accumulated grievances. And I am able to empathize by listening.
When people saw you as an American, and I know...
No. I carry an Irish passport.
You carry an Irish passport.
I identify myself at all times as being Irish. And
does that help?
It sure does. It sure does.
How does that help?
One has to say, and I can say this unequivocally, that all Iraqis that I have met, and I've met Iraqis at every level, resent what is called the occupation. And they resent that Americans are treated differently at checkpoints, that even the most senior, even ministers of government, have to go through checkpoints in Iraq. Americans, low-level employees of the State Department, do not.
And what about you?
There are me. When I'm in Iraq, I'm a prisoner. literally a prisoner. I can only move from place to place if I'm with somebody carrying the necessary identification to move me to that place. So Iraq is within the green zone, it's entirely segregated according to the color of the card you carry, because that card identifies your position. I can leave my hotel to go to the first checkpoint, but as soon as I get to the first checkpoint, I am not allowed through if I'm not accompanied by somebody who has the authority to take me through. And a funny example of that was that I was trying to meet with some members of the United Nations, but the people I was meeting with only had authority to get to a certain checkpoint. I had the authority to walk to that checkpoint, but not to go through it. So, in fact, if we wanted to talk to each other, we had to use bullhorns to talk over the checkpoint. So a whole day can go by, if you have a meeting, even within the green zone, of hours going through checkpoints, and then you get to meet the person, then the electricity goes out, then the internet goes down, and I have spent a lot of time in the Iraqi parliament, and nothing works there. I mean, the lights go out, internet works every other day. People have to leave work early because of fighting in such places, a sadder city, so the average work day might be at best 5 hours.
Is this one of the reasons why you hold the meetings in Finland and not in Iraq?
Yes. In fact, one of the comments I think made to Mac when he was leaving by Minister Al-Hakim, who's the Minister of Dialogue and National Reconciliation, was that he didn't think they would have the capacity to hold a conference of the type we had just had in Finland in Iraq. The lack of skills at every level is that nothing gets done. After I had sent invitations by email 3 times to participants in Iraq, because of having been there so often, I kind of took the position that they probably didn't get the emails. So I had to go there to verify whether or not they got the invitations. Nobody had received an invitation. So when the Iraqis are asked to meet benchmarks, what's not taken into consideration is whether or not they have the internal administrative capacity to do so, whether they have the structure to do so. I mean, the telephone system, Arakna, the national telephone system, doesn't work.
Mac Maharaj, for many years you were head of the African National Congress's underground, and the ANC was an armed militant group in the apartheid era. Because of that, do you feel a kind of understanding of why some Iraqi groups are armed groups now, having come from an armed group yourself?
Yes, I think so, because I've come to the position that people take to arms for a reason. Something pushes them to it. And if we want them to lay down their arms, it cannot be by a unilateral imposition or by crushing them. We have to lay a basis to say, what is your political problem? Here is a forum. Come and talk. And unless we do that, we will only treat the problem at its symptom level rather than at its root causes. So, to put it very sharply and extremely, I come from a background that says that in humankind's march to freedom, people have a right to revolt against tyranny. And once you acknowledge that right, you create the basis for enemies to sit at the table. At some stage in every conflict, armed conflict, there will have to be negotiations, even if it is between a victor signing a truce with the vanquished. But there will be negotiations.
Mac, I know you have to leave our conversation because you need to go and teach a class now. Thank you very much for participating in the conversation. Porik, not that I want to end on a discouraging note, but after the IRA put down its arms, you wrote an op-ed basically saying, you know, great, the IRA puts down its arms and then along comes the jihadis. Is it very discouraging for you to know that, you know, in all likelihood, one conflict is resolved and another one comes along. One fanatical group, and you describe the IRA as fanatical, puts down its arms, and another fanatical group picks up theirs or picks up, you know, more stronger weapons.
No, I see that in the nature of things, Terry. It took 40 years of effort to bring the Northern Ireland conflict to what I wouldn't call an end, but to a settlement that must be nurtured over the years in order for it to work. But there is a way of reaching people who are in militant organizations, and there is a way of drawing them slowly into a process. You cannot do it by the manner in which the Sadrists are being told to lay down their arms or the Mahi army in Baghdad by conducting guerrilla warfare, targeting people from 70,000 feet. I mean, this is just doubling and tripling the support for the militias. They must be talked to. They must be brought into the process. And in the end, if we are honest about it, someplace, someday, someone will have to make contact with Al-Qaeda and say, we have come to talk.
Of course, the people with arms have to be ready to talk, too. There was going to be a representative from Muqtada al-Sadr's group, but he never made it to the Helsinki conference in April. And he said that there was a problem with the plane, but, you know, I'm skeptical by nature, so I figure who knows if that was really the problem.
No, it wasn't a problem. Wasn't a problem with the plane. I talked to him on the Thursday morning at 11 o'clock. And the plane was due to leave Baghdad at 3. And he said that he was caught in Sadr City, that he couldn't get out. There was fighting going on, and he wasn't able to make it out. Now, that same person attended Helsinki 1 and signed off to the principles of Helsinki 1. I will go back to him and be talking to him within the next month, and I would be asking him to find ways that I can make contact with people that are in fact closer to al-Sadr with the view to bringing the message that there is a table, that they are welcome at the table, and there are no preconditions.
One more question. You've been going to Iraq about 2 weeks out of every month to help organize these conflict resolution meetings that you've been holding in Helsinki. It's really hard from everything I've heard to go in and out of Iraq and to, you know, adjust to the safety of the United States and then go back and expose yourself to the dysfunction and the dangers of Iraq. Is this wreaking havoc with you psychologically and emotionally to be going back and forth on such a regular basis?
Yes, it is definitely having an impact, a larger one than I thought. Iraq, at least in the Green Zone, is a place of, to me, of spiritual despair, where the stories you hear from people of what they have gone through and are going through and the inability of the government to deliver on basic services is heartbreaking. And then to contrast that with the way in which many ministers and government officials live within the Green Zone in conditions of maximum security, but they live in isolation from the people. And the American presence, occupation, whatever you wish to call it, is a large part of the problem. But it is also recognized at this point that a precipitous withdrawal would probably result in a civil war. And I think this is something that should be asked of presidential candidates when they are formulating policies regarding the withdrawal of American troops. Are they ever saying to themselves, what is good for the Iraqis? What responsibilities do we have to them? Must we not first ask them, what do you want us to do? What should we do to leave?
I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and be safe on your travels. Thank you.
Thank you.
Purug O'Malley is a professor of peace and reconciliation at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He hopes to hold the next round of Iraq peace talks in Baghdad.